accession number 10599, Reel 2.
Major English, Reel 2. We were talking about German air activity, Major.
Yes. On exercises, all messages had to be preceded by the word exercise. And we had this air raid on the battalion headquarters vehicles. And one man was killed with this bomb. And I remember the message coming over, not repeat, not exercise. We've just had a German air raid and we've had one casualty. But other than that, we weren't really too bothered about, we weren't kept awake at night with raids. Occasionally they went over to Bristol, but it was all pretty minor.
Were you involved in any major invasion scares?
Well, I think, if I remember rightly, I was with the 69th Brigade at the time of the Battle of Britain, and we did have three occasions, and one in particular where they really thought invasion was imminent, and everybody was, the orders were to carry on with their work, but until further alarms or messages came through, but nevertheless everyone was very much on the qui vive. I think it's difficult to visualise really what would have happened, but I think insofar as we could, everyone was ready to meet whatever came.
Who was commanding the battalion at this time?
Well, the RCO had been wounded in France, Colonel Beard. But he came back fairly soon afterwards. He came back, I think, when we were at Rugeley and took over command from Ross McLaren, who became commanding in France. He was a territorial major. And then we went down to Weymouth, and Colonel Beard was given the job of officer in command of all the defences of Weymouth, which included troops of various sorts and naval personnel and this type of thing. And so Ross McLaren took over again of the battalion when we were busy there on the beaches. And then in due course, Tim Beard was relieved of that job, and he commanded again then right through till we got to the Middle East.
Do you recall when the battalion moved to Weymouth?
yes, this would be towards the end of June, 1940.
On the eve of going abroad, Major, could you describe the organisation of the battalion?
Well, we were basically the same as we had been. We were four rifle companies, battalion headquarters, four rifle companies and a headquarter company. And the headquarter company consisted of a signal platoon, an ACAC platoon, a pioneer platoon, an MT platoon and the quartermaster's department. And a mortar platoon and a carrier platoon. And it was only later on, I think I'm right in saying, in the Middle East, where we split the mortars and the carriers and the anti-tank platoon off into another company called Support Company. And each rifle company had three platoons, 30 men, and a company headquarters. And that was basically the organisation we'd started with and went through pretty well through. At one later on in for a period in the Middle East, we were only three rifle companies, but well, for four from June 42 onwards until we came back to from Sicily, actually we were only three rifle companies.
What weapons were in anti-aircraft AA?
They were initially Bren guns, with a 1500 weight truck, and really mounted in an ACAC row. So, and they were largely for the ACAC defense of battalion headquarters.
What caliber anti-tank guns did the unit have?
Well, we in 1940 when we went to France, we had each platoon had a Boy's rifle, 0.5 Boy's rifle, which was a rather heavy, cumbersome thing, and not terribly effective. And then the anti-tank platoon was issued with 2-pounders, and in fact, from the early days in the BEF, there was a brigade anti-tank company at that time, and there were three platoons of each with 4 2-pounders, and then they finished with that, and the anti-tank platoons were separated out back to battalions. And we had 6 2-pounders until Alamein, or just after Alamein, and began to get 6-pounders.
What was the number and caliber of the mortars that you had?
We had initially 2 3-inch mortars, and then in 1940 or 41 the establishment was increased to 6. And then each platoon had a 2-inch mortar, each rifle platoon. So, which were all those were extremely useful weapons, except that the 3-inch mortars were somewhat outranged for the Germans' equivalent.
And what equipment did the signal platoon have?
Well, the signal platoon at that time was using 18 sets, as they were called, and there was establishment of 18 sets was one to each rifle company, one to headquarter company, one to the quartermaster, and then latterly support company.
Were they particularly reliable, the sets?
No, not really. They were anything but, really. They were carried on the back, fairly bulky thing, perhaps about 1 foot by 2 foot, something like that. Fairly heavy, not too bad. But it was often difficult to get through, and although sometimes they worked well, I have quite good memories of them in action, actually working fairly well. In some cases, for the nature of the ground or possibly the imperfections of the operator, you know, one lost communication. But I mean, when you think of what they've got now, it's ridiculous, really, the way we've faffed about.
Had the complement of the carrier platoon changed since France?
Yes, there was some change in personnel, but in France we had 10 carriers, each with 3 men, and that included the platoon commander, and that was that establishment continued right through the war, actually. And that, for a subaltern, was really the plum job.
So, you were preparing to go abroad. in what form was that organized? Did you have forewarning that you were going?
Yes, we definitely knew we were destined for abroad. We didn't know where. And in due course, we were issued with khaki drill uniform and with dreadful topees and all this sort of thing. And, you know, I had to see that everything was there and proper, and so the whole battalion paraded in this kit. And I often think of the... If there'd only been sort of German spy knocking around, and you'd see this battalion parading in this kit, and you'd say, well, they're not exactly going to Iceland. But and there was quite a bit of that, and we had the inevitable division commander and so on down inspections of this. And there was during the last month or so, there was a lot of preparations of that sort. And we had to try and get everybody away and leave and get them back and in time and still run the battalion. So, yes, I think we definitely knew. But, of course, we didn't know where we were going, although we had at that time it was a reasonable assumption that we'd be going to the Middle East. But we didn't know for sure.
Do you recall your send-off? From were you at Weymouth at this time?
No. We had the battalion had moved to West Dorset. Really, we were at into Devon. In fact, we were at Honiton. The 8th was at Honiton, and the other battalions in was the one at Tiverton. The 9th was at Tiverton. And the 6th, I forget, Wibberliscombe, I think. And so we moved from Dorset really into Devon. Now, I'd, as I mentioned earlier, left before the main body of the battalion, so I don't know, no doubt there were parties and so on before we left, but I don't know what sort of send-off we had. And as far as leaving Glasgow was concerned, one just got out of the train and into a vehicle and then filed off and onto the ship.
And what ship was that? Do you recall its name?
Yes, the Duchess of Richmond. And it was a most extraordinary setup, really, on this ship, because it had been whether you would call it a cruise liner, but it was a fairly well-appointed ship, which was used to crossing the Atlantic, and the arrangements of the officers were ridiculously lavish, really. They were absolutely sort of pre-war scale and pre-war menus and all this sort of thing in the dining saloon. And we were four to a cabin, fairly comfortable, really. The men, unfortunately, were lower down and a lot more cramped, and it was a bit all really inequitable, really. I think, I don't know when they stopped that, but it must have been after we got to the Middle East, probably in the middle of the war, they said it was absolutely ridiculous and put the whole thing onto a proper wartime footing. But meanwhile, we luxuriated with the food and the drink and that we had. I mean, there were gin and grapefruits of fivepence. So we employed ourselves pretty well, actually. We did weapon training and all sorts of other sort of training and got people to give talks and of course it was regular boat drills.
Were you in a convoy?
Yes, we left. There was, I think, 3 ships carrying troops, of which we were the largest. And we had an escort of about 12 destroyers, and we carried on like that for several days. And to start with, it was very rough, and majority of the battalion was flat on its back, really. And again, the men suffered because down below. But we got our sea legs gradually, and we got well out into the Atlantic. We were really going west. We thought we were going west for ages. And then one morning we woke up and all the destroyers had gone, and we were left there sailing on our own. We thought, well, this is rather a queer do. And then over the radio we heard that the Hood had been sunk. And this was the Scharnhorst, I think, wasn't it?
Bismarck,
time. It was that sunk the Hood. And all the destroyers were called off for this action. And then later on, a few days later, I think we got 2 came, and it was our escort. And eventually we turned south. And as far as we knew, everything was uneventful. But when we got to Durban, we stopped at Durban and we met some of the naval chaps who'd been escorted, you know, and we said, oh, pretty quiet trip, and he said, oh well, it wasn't really. They had various submarine alarms and this sort of thing,
which you knew nothing about,
which,
of course,
we didn't know anything about. There was one very unfortunate incident. There was on one of the naval ships, there was an old Swordfish biplane, and it was decided by somebody it would be a good thing to practice the anti-aircraft crews, because some of the ships had Bofors anti-aircraft guns, and we mounted our Bren guns in an ACAC row, and this thing flew around and we aimed at it and all this sort of thing, and fire orders were given. And then one day we were watching, this thing was flying around and sort of diving down, and then they were pulled out of the dive and went into sea, and the pilot was lost, which was a rather depressing thing for everybody.
Was there any forms of illnesses or diseases on the ship on this long journey?
Nothing very much at all. I don't recollect people, once they got over their seasickness, being, I suppose there must have been the odd few, but it wasn't spectacular at all.
How did you keep the men entertained?
Well, it wasn't always easy. When we crossed the equator, we had a sort of traditional crossing the line thing, and I remember we ran a boxing tournament, rigged a ring up, and we had sing songs and this sort of thing. It was 6 weeks, I think, we were at sea. And so it was quite a job to exercise one's mind about how to keep people from getting too bored, really. But we kept active during the day as much as we could.
Did conditions on board the ship worsen as the heat increased?
Yes, I think lower down it did get pretty fairly stifling, and it was a ship that was really designed for northern European waters and not really for the tropics, so it did get bad. And I remember we allowed some of the men on a rota basis to sleep on the deck at night.
Do you recall your reception in Durban?
Yes, absolutely marvellous. We were the first convoy that were allowed to land. There'd been a break because there'd been one convoy where the Australians had run amok in Durban and caused goodness knows how much damage, and they stopped people going ashore for certainly one convoy after that, and maybe more than that. Anyway, we were the first allowed to land, and we got came down off the ship and onto the quay, and there's a whole series of cars came along and said, come with us, and we were taken out. There were three or four of us taken out and given meals and taken out in the country and see the thing, and they did the same for everybody, all ranks. Tremendous, absolutely.
And how long were you there?
As I remember, we were there 3 days, I think.
So then you would leave to go up the Red Sea.
Yes.
And into Egypt.
Yes, we had when we were there, we had a parade through Durban and church service and this sort of thing. There was one incident which I think it is probably fair to mention, which was really quite dramatic at the time, is when we were about to leave Durban, there's reinforcements, New Zealanders, who had been wounded and perhaps been in hospital and that sort of thing. And they were due to join the ship, because on our ship there was not only the 8DLI, there was a lot of RAF details. And anyway, this, I suppose about 20 men arrived on the thing, and they reported to the OC troops and came on, and they were taken down to their, down below to where they were going to be, and they didn't think much of this, and they walked off again. They said, we're not going in there. And so they reformed on the quay. And eventually the OC troops came down. Now, he was a superannuated officer, in other words, retired officer from the East Yorks. And obviously a very bad appointment, because I think life in the East had got him down, really, and he couldn't keep off the bottle. And the man was a complete menace, really. But anyway, he came down and he ordered these chaps onto the ship, and they said they weren't going. So he said, right, he said, well, if you don't go, he said, I've got Bren guns up there, I'll give the order to open fire. And our Brigadier Redman, who would later become a full general, he'd been watching this. And he said, I think this is where I take over. And he went down and he ordered the OC troops, who was only a lieutenant colonel, back to his cabin. And he talked to the sergeant. And after that, they went on, came no bother. But it was just tricky for a few minutes. Anyway, then we, as you say, we left Durban and sailed north and came into the Red Sea. And I remember it was really absolutely extraordinary, because it was absolutely flat calm. And we sailed up to Port Tewfik. And there the ship couldn't pull into the side. We had to go ashore on the most extraordinary Arab barges, which plied to and from. And then we were taken from there, from transport to Abyssinia.
What date was this, Major?
This was, we landed in July. July, I could look the date up. I should have added that the whole voyage up to Aden, we did have the escort of the Exeter, HMS Exeter, which was a cruiser later to be involved in the Battle of the River Plate. And that stayed with us all the time when the destroyers left. And it was on that the little Swordfish aeroplane flew from that. And then Dayton, that left us, and we were unescorted after that, but we were out of danger by then. And then, as I say, we landed at Port Tewfik, and were taken to by convoy to a camp at Abyssinia.
What was your first impressions of Egypt?
Hot and dusty, and rather dirty. But the camp we were in was all right. We didn't have very long there. I think about a week or 10 days settling down, and then we were sent to Cyprus.
In the week and 10 days, what kind of things were you doing?
Well, getting sorted out, inspecting the kit, seeing it was all in order, doing a bit of training, marching by compass and this sort of thing. Largely administration.
What was the morale of the battalion like?
Well, I think pretty good. I think if we'd been stuck in Egypt for too long, it would have gone down. But we weren't there really long enough for that. And you know, people were still interested in their surroundings and new country and new atmosphere. And that sort of thing.
So you weren't in this camp very long. What date did you move up to go to Cyprus?
We moved towards the end of July, probably about the 20th, and we left from Port Said. And at that time, I think Crete had been lost, and the generals were worried that Cyprus was going to be attacked in the same way. And so 50 Day was moved to Cyprus. And we were put on a mine-laying cruiser, which was the fastest ship in the Navy. And I must admit, we went from Port Said to mainly at night to Famagusta in Cyprus, extremely fast. And the Navy were naturally wary. They'd suffered evacuation of Greece and of Crete and considerable casualties from the air. And we should have landed in Famagusta before dawn, but for one reason or another, it was pretty broad daylight at the time.